Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. You can take the most basic things for granted until you suffer a stroke. How one young woman used the kitchen as her therapy for recovery. Get some good bread and cheese and get ready to toast it because April is Grilled Cheese Month. I'll check in with the cheese grilling expert today. Water bottles? Should you use a plastic one? The solution to this dilemma is here for you. But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're coming up on two of the biggest holidays of the spring, Passover, which starts on Wednesday the 8th, and then Easter, which is Sunday the 12th of April. And luckily, we have Amelia Saltzman here. She's the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. And Amelia, you're here at the market today. You've got some ideas, I'm sure. Please share with us what you're thinking about cooking this holiday season.
Well, this is just the perfect time to take advantage of all the wonderful, brilliantly green vegetables we've got out there. And what I like to do is make a huge, I don't know, let's call it a melange of all bright spring green vegetables. So here's what I like to do. I like to use a mix of bitter and sweet. So I'm going to take some onions, maybe even some leeks, and some green garlic, which is still around. Saute that in a big pot. And then I'm going to layer in the next level of vegetables. In other words, the ones that are going to take the longest to cook. So I'm going to use some chard. And I'm going to cut that into ribbons, add that to the pot, saute it up a little bit, let it get limp. Then I'm going to get a couple of bunches of big fat asparagus. And I'm going to get a pound or two of sweet green peas. And I'm also going to get, I just saw that fava beans are finally here. They're so late this year. So that's going to be the sweet peas, slightly bitter favas. And so once the chard is soft and the onions are soft, then I'm going to cut up all the asparagus in maybe inch-long pieces, stir those in, add in the peas, which I've shelled, but I don't pre-cook, and the favas, which I have peeled and blanched first, and I'll tell you how to do that in a second. And then just stir that up, maybe some lemon zest over the whole thing, a little salt, a little white pepper. But you can just make this as big as you like for however many people, and it's beautiful, mounded on a big serving platter.
Okay, now tell us how to prep those fava beans before you just put them in there for the final stir.
You've got to get them out of their cushiony pod, and then just bring some water to boil. Drop all the fava beans in for about 2 minutes, and that should loosen the skin. Drain them when they're cool enough to handle. Just slip off that extra little skin.
And remind us again why they're worth all this trouble to go to prepare them.
Well, they're like little emeralds in your dish. They have this wonderful nutty, bitter, sweet flavor. And you know, the nice thing about them is because they are a bit labor intensive, a little goes a long way. And they just add a wonderful element to the dish.
Okay, well, that's wonderful, springy and seasonal. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Happy holidays.
Same to you, Amelia. That was Amelia Saltzman. She is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. It's easy to see where she gets her inspiration. And she's here today sharing another wonderful seasonal recipe with us. We're going to follow up with Amelia's suggestion to get some great asparagus now with Juan Acevedo. And he works with Zuckerman Farm. They come all the way down from Stockton at this time of year. They are in several markets in the LA area year-round. Yep. Here in Santa Monica, Juan comes in to the Wednesday market with asparagus in the spring. Now, can you explain to us, Juan, why this asparagus is so special?
Flavor and quality is special because we bring asparagus only in a season time. California asparagus is real, real sweeter, tender. Excellent quality.
So what is the peak asparagus season?
February to May.
Okay.
Especially 13, 14 weeks depend the weather.
And that's the only time this asparagus is grown?
It's grown, yes.
Really? Now you've got all different sizes. You have what's called jumbo.
Jumbo is excellent because it's come from younger plants.
Younger
about
plants.
About 2 years old. Mm-hmm. Other sizes like medium or thin size is 6-7 years in the fields.
Oh, so the jumbo only comes off the youngest plants.
Youngest plants,
oh,
yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's why it's thick and sweeter and tender.
Oh, mm-hmm. It is very good.
Yeah. This is the best in quality, the best in flavor, too.
Now, a lot of the chefs I know, they'll peel the bigger asparagus.
Well,
do
this
you
is
think
wrong.
No,
neither.
Why?
Just cut off in the end.
Yeah?
Just a little bit.
Okay, now what about the purple asparagus? Are you going to have that?
This year coming, 2-3 more weeks, it's ready.
Okay, and how different does that taste from the green?
More sweeter in the jumbo.
Really?
For sure.
Now, Juan, I know you guys are in a lot of markets down here in the LA area.
23 markets a week.
Really?
Beverly Hills, Hollywood, Studio City, Encino.
All right, that was Juan Alceveda, and he is with Zuckerman Farm. They're very well known for their seasonal sweet asparagus. Very delicious. I just wanted to give everybody a little update on the whole pistachio salmonella situation. The pistachio recall came from a processing plant in the town of Tarabella. It's a processing plant called Seton, S-E-T-T-O-N processing. I'm happy to report that neither our pistachio growers, Avila Farms or Santa Barbara Pistachios, use that facility for processing their pistachios. We have certificates of inspection from both of our pistachio processing plants that our farmers use that have so far received a clean bill of health. So for the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
See what Laura Avery just talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'd really love to collect your ideas for fresh produce there, too. Leave a comment on the site with your delicious ideas for preparing fresh fruits and vegetables. At the age of 21, most of us have our whole life in front of us. That is, until you have a debilitating stroke. How one woman survived a stroke and a coma, and how the kitchen brought her back to life. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Many people find solace in the kitchen. Throwing yourself into a recipe can be absolutely the best therapy there is. Adrienne Kane was 2 weeks from her college graduation when she suffered a stroke which left her paralyzed on her right side. After extensive rehabilitation, she returned to the kitchen. Hi, Adrienne. Your stroke occurred to you at a very young age, which is kind of unusual. What happened?
Well, I was 21 years old, and it was an AVM, which is an arterial venous malformation, and a hemorrhagic stroke. And it was really just a malformation of the capillaries in my brain that had been present since birth, but no one really knew about. I wasn't a very rough and tumble child that had required some sort of MRI. So it was in existence, but no one knew until the rupture.
So you were incapacitated almost completely for a while, and you were in the hospital for how long?
Well, I was in the ICU unit for about a month, and then I was transferred for an additional month to a rehabilitation hospital.
You have some pretty vivid descriptions of eating while you were in the hospital. What was the food like?
Well, the food was pretty typical hospital food, which unfortunately is none too great. Sort of bland yet salty, and there were kind of odd casseroles and tepid cups of soup and odd sandwiches on buns that I had never seen before.
So did the frustration with the hospital food cause you to request that food be brought to you?
Of course. I was, when the doctors gave me the all clear to eat again, I requested all sorts of snack foods in particular to be brought to me from my visitors, boxes of See's chocolates and cheese crackers and sort of all of the foods that were really strong in flavor and sort of overcame this new muted reality that I had.
And so talk to me a little bit about this muted reality. When you first started to eat again, did food taste different?
Food didn't have as great of a taste as I remembered it to have. It was all like I was eating a bunch of oatmeal all of the time. And gradually that sort of came back.
So when you were post-rehabilitation, where did food start to fit into your mind about what you were going to do with your life?
I think that it came gradually. I mean, part of my rehabilitation and my occupational therapy was being in the kitchen. And just as soon as I was out of the hospital and in the rehabilitation center, there was a mock kitchen set up, and I was taught once again how to cut and be somewhat dexterous, yet do it one-handed. And I found that I took great solace in these sort of, you know, petty kitchen activities.
So you had been right-handed previously.
I had been right-handed. I ate with my left hand before, but I wrote with my right.
And I would imagine chopping, you had to learn how to use a chef's knife with your left hand.
I did. What I sort of do now, because I still have a definite weakness on the right side of my body, I kind of brace, if I'm cutting vegetables, I brace them with my right hand, and then I use the chef's knife and cut them with my left.
So did you actually jump into food as a career?
I sort of did. I mean, the rehabilitation and sort of becoming comfortable in my new body took, you know, several years. But I eventually parlayed my love of food into a small catering company, which I opened in Berkeley, California at the time.
That's pretty incredible. Do you remember what the first thing was that you made once you were out of the hospital where you were able to say to yourself, it's going to be okay?
I do remember making a Swiss chard frittata with a friend of mine who had came down to my parents' house, which was where I was staying for those few months after my AVM. And we sort of made the frittata and ate the frittata. And it was just as much about the conversation as it was the activity.
It was normal.
Absolutely. I think that's what I love about being active in the kitchen, is that my disability sort of falls away.
Well, Adrienne, your book, Cooking and Screaming, is really quite wonderful. And thank you so much for finding the time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Adrienne Kane is the author of Cooking and Screaming. Read more about her on her blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for details. Is there anything more perfect than a grilled cheese sandwich? Probably, but let's pretend for this month that there's nothing better. April is Grilled Cheese Month, and no one celebrates it with more fun than Annie Myler of Clementine in Century City.
Hi, I'm Annie Myler from Clementine, and my favorite way to make a grilled cheese is actually not to make it myself, to have somebody make it for me. I think there's really something special about either having it made for you or making it for someone else, just that kind of sharing of something that's so nostalgic for people. If I am making it, or if someone were going to make one for me, I think what I'd want is, we make our own English muffin bread, which I love for grilled cheese because it has lots of nooks and crannies in it. It's a loaf bread, but you can put a lot of butter on the outside. I like that with cheddar cheese, usually yellow cheddar. I'm not sure why it matters to me, but a sharp, good one. And some kind of salty ham or bacon, but currently my favorite is ham, like a nice bone-in smoked ham. and then something pickly like a cornichon or an olive or something tart. And also I like yellow mustard, just the cheap yellow mustard. I just think that gives it a nice tang. And then I like to cook it really slow. That helps it to get really nice and crispy and worth the wait. I would serve it with a Coke in a short glass, and I would put half large cubes and half crushed ice. And that, to me, is like a perfect lunch.
Find Annie Meidler's grilled cheese sandwiches, plus you can indulge in her daily grilled cheese specials this month at Clementine. Clementine is on Ainslie Avenue, just across Santa Monica Boulevard from Westfield Century City. I want to hear your favorite grilled cheese recipes. Go to our site at kcrw.com/goodfood and post a comment about your ways of melting cheese. The Good Food blog is full of delicious bites, too. In fact, you can find out how to make grilled cheese with an iron. Are you a vegetarian? Maybe you think about it a lot. It's kind of hard to be a moral person and silently advocate the killing of animals so we can have burgers. I'm going to take a different tack next. I've asked a psychotherapist to explain what goes on to resolve a love of animals with a love of eating meat. Get ready for the couch. I'll be right back on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Often as we sit down to eat a hamburger or a side of bacon, we find ourselves pondering the origins of that meat on our plate. Psychoanalyst Jeffrey Mason considers what goes through your head when you encounter that meat at the dinner table. His latest book is The Face on Your Plate, The Truth About Food. You have a really interesting career history as a Freudian psychoanalyst. What led you to write a book about food?
Well, I gave up studying humans as being an impossible task and decided to look at animals and animal emotions, which fascinated me. What is it that animals feel? I remember when I was first married, my wife used to make lemon veal, and it never occurred to me during that entire time that I would eat this dish what it was.
What kind of psychological factors are at work here that allow us to not really take in what veal is?
I do believe that Freud was right on certain issues, and one of those issues was the defense mechanisms, that we do defend ourselves against certain unpleasant associations, against recognizing certain truths. I think that almost as a species, we are in denial.
And do you think that that ever functioned as a necessary mechanism in order to just survive, to get through the day?
Yeah. I mean, I think there is such a thing as benign denial. There are things we need not to know in order to survive. But there are also times, and I think those are far more frequent, when we simply will ourselves not to know something that we ought to know about.
So at some point in a child's growing up, whether or not they grow up in a vegetarian household or a conscious meat-eating household or an unconscious meat-eating household, there must be an aha moment for that child when they realize, when they make the connection that what they're eating is an animal.
Yes, I find that fascinating. And one of the things I did was go to farms in many countries and try and talk to farmers. And I found that so frustrating because—
Why?
Well, they just wouldn't talk about it. They didn't want, when I would ask them, well, how do you feel about this? Nothing. I mean, does it bother you to kill? No. Do you ever think? No. You know, I never got anywhere. And eventually I turned to the children on farms, and they had a very different reaction. they were always aware of what was happening. And especially if I got to speak to them without their parents present, which I would try to do, they would tell me about that aha moment, the moment when they suddenly realized that this was an animal that was who was being killed and an animal whom they were eating. Almost all these kids on farms had a moment when they said, I don't want to do this. I don't want to kill that animal. I don't want to eat that animal.
So do you think that in order for humankind to change our mindset, to be able to let go of the denial, we need to have relationships with animals that we normally refer to as livestock, which is this strange sort of category that's neither pet nor wild?
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting term. I hadn't thought about it until you used the word livestock. I mean, what is that supposed to mean? I mean, I have noticed that we do avoid using words that mean anything to us. I mentioned veal or the word hamburger. It doesn't have associations. And even pork, we don't say, I'll have pig, give me the pig. Mind you, chicken is an exception. We do that. But by and large, we try to distance ourselves, to remove ourselves from what we're doing. We don't want to be reminded that this is a sentient being. This is an animal who has feelings very much like our own. All of these animals have family relationships.
I mean, when I think about humankind, I think about a species that developed as fighting its to the top of the food chain through hunting and foraging, which involved killing and consuming animals. Do you feel that we're so, quote, evolved that we no longer have that atavistic need in us?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think that the idea that we've always eaten meat is probably false. So I wouldn't necessarily see it as an evolution. However, it is true that we are the only species who has the choice about what we eat. I mean, you can't really impose a diet on a cat. I mean, you can try, but they don't like it. They're real carnivores, and they're what we call obligate carnivores. They're obliged to eat meat. That's how they evolved. We did not evolve like that, and we can survive very well on a vegan diet, a vegetarian diet, just about anything. And certainly we do also survive on meat. So we are the only species who has a choice. And I think at this point in our existence, both for the environment, for our own health, and for the sake of animals, it really makes sense to eat less meat or no meat and less animal products or no animal products at all.
Jeffrey Mason, thank you very much. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Mason is a trained Freudian psychoanalyst. He's written a book about vegetarianism called The Face on Your Plate, The Truth About Food. I want to hear what you have to say about this subject. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to comment and also to tell us what you think. Being green really can give me anxiety, like the moral dilemma that crops up around which water bottle to use. One of our listeners felt the same. She asked if washing a reusable bottle was better for the environment, even in drought-plagued California. The answer is coming up next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. You're trying to make greener choices for your home and your life, often the right answer isn't really clear. Every choice seems to have some ramification. If you choose between filling a landfill and wasting water, what kind of choice is that? A listener wrote to us with this very question. She wondered, particularly here in California, where water's at a premium, if washing glass repeatedly was the best eco-friendly choice, and she wondered maybe plastic has its place. We found someone to answer this tricky eco question. Jen Savage wrote the book The Green Parent, a kid-friendly guide to earth-friendly living. Is it worse to repeatedly wash a glass container or to use a plastic one and recycle it?
The short answer is it's better to use the glass and to wash it continually rather than to use a disposable plastic bottle. Even when there's a shortage of water, you're not talking about huge differences with water. And looking worldwide, it takes about 24 gallons of water to make 1 pound of plastic, whereas it takes less than half of that to make a pound of glass. And in addition, when you're filling up the landfill, there's lots more to consider worldwide.
You mean in terms of toxins that break down from the plastics?
Exactly. Break down both into the water that's in the bottle and once they get into the environment.
So let's talk about dishwashing, because a lot of people have always looked at me askance because I use a dishwasher. But I've always thought to myself, well, if I lightly rinse dishes and then put them in the dishwasher and then turn the dishwasher on when it's really full, that I would probably be using less water than someone who hand washes every dish.
You know, you're absolutely right. And
woohoo!
This is something I was shocked about. And when I went to do the research for the book, I couldn't believe it. There's been studies done, and they've compared people who hand wash dishes to people who use a dishwasher, and they've looked at all the aspects, you know, whether or not you scrape the food off before you put it in the dishwasher, scrape the food off before you hand wash, if you fill the basin of the sink with water, or if you just let the water run, and no matter what, the dishwasher won. And it was really disturbing to me to learn that, because even older style dishwashers use like roughly 5 or so gallons of water, whereas hand washing, conservative hand washing uses about 20 gallons of water.
Wow, that's huge.
It is, and it really, really made me mad to learn that, but it's one of those surprising things that you wouldn't have expected it, but it's true. And now they have really super eco-friendly dishwashers that use like two or less gallons of water per cycle. So you can really, you know, bring those numbers down. You when you are hand washing, because I don't have a choice, I don't have a dishwasher. So you can do things to try to conserve water and energy, like filling up the sink rather than letting the water run, doing all your dishes at once, like you just said you did with the dishwasher, hand washing, doing that with your hand washing helps too, because you're not, you know, making that dish basin of hot water a bunch of times, and scraping food off the plate rather than trying to rinse it off with the water. That all helps, and it can bring your numbers down quite a bit, but it's still hard to match a dishwasher.
Now, of course, the other conundrum that we had, ecologically speaking, was the paper or plastic question in the grocery store.
Right.
And so now the answer seems to be neither.
That's right. I think for so long, those two industries, paper and plastic, kept trying to have studies and point the ugly finger at the other industry and, you know, make theirs out to be the better, more eco-friendly product. And it's finally, people have finally realized that really just neither one is good for the planet. They both have dramatic issues. The plastic, as we've just talked about, with the toxins that are produced from even making the plastic and all the resources that are used, and with the paper, sure, they will biodegrade, but we're cutting down all those trees to make them. Whereas it's so easy now to use a reusable bag.
So are there any other quick suggestions that you have for eco-friendly choices in the kitchen?
The things I try to do are to minimize disposables, and that goes for, you know, kind of what we were just talking about, disposable grocery bags, disposable water bottles, disposable Ziploc baggies. I don't use those at all anymore. We just found either using a reusable Tupperware container, or they make now like a cloth mat that kind of folds up and then Velcros on itself. There's one called a wrapping mat. I know there's a few different kinds.
I wonder if wax paper is ever going to stage a comeback.
You know, I've heard, I just actually read a tinfoil versus wax paper blog post, you know, where this person completely analyzed the eco impact of the two. But the whole time I just kept thinking to myself that it was the same exact thing as the paper versus plastic argument. Why you wouldn't just use a reusable item, I don't know.
Jen Savage is the author of The Green Parent, a kid-friendly guide to earth-friendly living. At kcrw.com/goodfood, you can find out more about how to be a green person. And if you've got any angst over paper, plastic, or water bottles, share it with all of us at kcrw.com/goodfood. We've got a comment feature on our site, and I'd love to hear from you. Think of it as therapy. Portland. It's become a city of idealists, healthy living, and now good food. There's a movement taking over downtown Portland that I wish would infiltrate into LA. Food carts that serve some creative, gourmet, and unique dishes can be found all over the place. I'll be right back with some favorites. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Leave it to Portland to come up with a crafty way to get gourmet food delivered conveniently and with less overhead. Food carts are popping up everywhere in this progressive city. We asked former Good Food producer and now Portland resident to go and sample some of the food carts and describe the culture for us. This is Terry Gelber. So give me sort of an overview of the whole food cart thing. I mean, do you really notice that there's more food carts than would be in a regular city?
You definitely do. When I first moved here 4 years ago, I noticed, you know, a scattering here and there around the city, concentrated in certain areas of downtown. And over the past 4 years, I've really seen them expand and start to populate those areas more so, and also to start showing up on other streets, you know, with retail shops and even in residential neighborhoods.
So do they sort of have like a gypsy wagon kind of feel?
That's a great way to describe it. They're much more gypsy wagons. Some are even constructed out of retro trailers. Some are left permanently in one place. Some move around.
Now, give us an idea of the range of the kinds of food available on these gypsy wagons.
Well, I'll start with downtown, and you have the gamut from Bosnian food to bento to, you know, German bratwurst, vegan. Carts come and go, so, you know, you'll kind of get hooked on something and you'll realize, oh, she's gone.
What's the top end usually?
I would say probably anywhere from $8 to $10. It doesn't go any higher than that. But really, the average price for this street food is, I would say, from $4 to $7. And let me tell you, you can get a great meal.
That seems so expensive when we're used to $1.25 tacos.
Well, you can get there are the $1.25 tacos, but I'm talking about like a meal on a plate, you know, a beautiful grilled cheese sandwich and a homemade cup of, you know, beef stroganoff for $6. You can't eat anywhere in Portland like that unless you're eating fast food, you know, and actually get a real lunch, a hot lunch.
That sounds delicious. Now, let's go back to the Bosnian cart. What kind of food is on the Bosnian cart?
The Bosnian cart is called Ziba's Pitas, and Ziba is this wonderful woman who moved here from Bosnia with her family. Ziba makes what she calls pitas, and they're not what we think of as pitas. It is a savory pie, essentially, made from an amazing strudel style dough that she makes every morning. And she serves it with this delicious red pepper condiment that she makes and a yogurt sauce with cucumbers. It is delicious. And let me tell you, $4.75, you have a great lunch and a healthy lunch.
Are there great breakfast carts?
There's a place called Flavor Spot, and you would love it. It's waffles mostly. For $2.50, you can get the basic butter and maple syrup. Jump up a couple dollars, and you can get the sausage maple, which is my favorite. And they serve it to you. So it's a regular waffle, and they fold it over a big slab of pork sausage. They fold it over, wrap it in some parchment paper, and there you go, $4.
So the city obviously facilitates the permitting of these little items. Gosh, I wish we could have those here.
They do. They're really supportive of it. They actually conducted a study recently to try to understand the viability of these carts. And the findings came out pretty positive. They found out that food carts have a positive impact on street vitality and neighborhood life in lower density residential neighborhoods, as well as in the high density downtown area.
Are there another couple you'd like to share with us?
There's one that you have to know about if you visit Portland. It's called Tabor. And Tabor is a little food cart downtown run by a Czech family, and they make Eastern European food. You can go there and get a huge portion of goulash. They make their famous chicken or pork schnitzel, a breaded fried schnitzel sandwich for $6 on a big ciabatta bun. They have weekly specials. I had a huzlaszki, which is a Polish stew with Polish sausage, and homemade spätzle. That is an incredible cart. There's also a new cart called Give Pizza a Chance. The guy that owns it makes the best whole wheat crust I've ever had, and for $2.50 you can get a lunch. So these carts are pretty amazing, and again, definitely a Portland phenomenon.
Terry Gelber's a former producer here at Good Food. To see some pictures of her favorite food carts and get a rundown of who she talked about, go to kcrw.com/goodfood. We don't really have so many food carts in L.A., but we do have mini malls. And this is where food writer Jonathan Gold finds nirvana. What and where to eat next when Good Food continues here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer and critic from the Los Angeles Weekly, Jonathan Gold, is here with us this morning to share another place to try. This, I think, is a little odd.
Porridge? What's odd about porridge?
Well, it's the adjective. What kind of porridge is it?
Korean porridge.
Okay, now when I hear Korean porridge, I imagine porridge that's red with chili.
No, not at all. It's actually a very special kind of porridge. It's an abalone porridge.
I don't even know what to say. It's an abalone porridge?
Right.
Okay.
And it's super popular in Korea. And like half of the dishes in Korean cuisine, it's probably a morning after remedy.
Interesting. So what is the grain part of the porridge?
Rice. The basic abalone porridge is rice boiled with water. You chop up an abalone or two, put it in, maybe a little sesame oil, salt, pepper if you're feeling ambitious. That's it. I've been going to two places, basically. One is called Mountain, which is as basic a restaurant as you will find in Koreatown, which is to say very, very basic. That you go in there and it smells like meat that's been boiling for days, and you can smell the kimchi, and you can... It's a strong smell when you get in there. And you get a table, and there's often a wait, and there's just two or three tables in there. Most of it's taken up with the kitchen, and there's, like, Korean grandmothers who, like, cluck at you very sympathetically. I think probably if you're going for porridge, especially if you're going for porridge at 4 in the morning, but if you're going for porridge, you want that home experience.
So you can go at 4 in the morning?
You can go at 4 in the morning. Mountain is 24 hours, 7-day restaurant. They have several things on the menu. They have a pretty good version of samgyetang. It's the chicken soup, except instead of a matzo ball, they have a whole game hen that's stuffed with sticky rice and ginseng.
I love that. Instead of a matzo ball, a whole chicken surrounding the dumpling.
It's that's not a bad way to go.
That's fantastic.
They have, you know, kimchi jjigae, the spicy kimchi soup, and they have soups that are variously described as the four boiled feet of an ox.
Did you get all four?
I don't know. The translation on the wall menu is not done by the same person who writes the menus for Spaco, let's say.
That's part of the entertainment of
It is part of the entertainment. But almost everybody gets the abalone porridge, which is rice that's been boiled till the rice falls apart. And it's a little slurry-like. In the middle of it is a single bright raw egg yolk that they put in there. So it sort of signifies bright, happy morning, even at 4 a.m.
That will come soon after you consume the bowl.
It will. And it has a really nice savory flavor. The problem with it, and everybody will tell you this, it has almost homeopathic quantity of abalone in there. I mean, you know, panning for abalone in there would probably be like panning for gold in a Sierra River. I mean, you're going to get like a couple flakes. but it's ultimately not going to be that rewarding an experience.
It's not a seafood experience.
No. So you enjoy it for what it is. It's cheap. It's $7.55. And you get sympathy. You get porridge. You get the condiments, which you can dump in if you want it spicy. There's a kimchi. And the thing that they always have at porridge restaurants, which to me is funny, which is this thing called jangjoreim, which is basically stewed beef. Beef that's cooked with sliced chilies in soy sauce till it's very like soft and luscious. So you literally have meat as a condiment, just as we've been told to use.
Perfect. So where is Mountain?
Mountain is on 8th Street and Barrendo in Koreatown. Then if you want to go a little bit uptown, there is Bonjuk, which is the Los Angeles branch of a rather big juk chain in Korea. And you go in there and it's very, very soothing. It's sort of corporate. The chairs are soft and low, like something you'd see in like a fancy bank lobby. There's art on the walls, even if it is giant blow-ups of porridge, and a photo menu that tells you the various health benefits of all the porridges. They play music that makes the music you heard on your last long elevator ride, you know, seem like AC/DC or something. If there's nothing to jangle the senses. The abalone porridge at Bonjuk is either twice as expensive or four times as expensive as Mountain. And I'm not sure it's as delicious, but it's a much more careful product. It's sort of the consistency of a risotto. The rice grains are distinct. There's a creaminess to it. It holds together. It's sort of like a little looser, like in the Venetian style, as opposed to like one of those, mm-hmm. you know, stand up and salute Milanese risottos. But it's recognizable in texture to somebody who's eaten like only the Italian form of it.
Tell us once again the names of the two places.
Bonjuk is at 3551 Wilshire in Los Angeles, and Mountain is at 30648 Street in Los Angeles.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer Jonathan Gold has a home at the LA Weekly. Find him here, though, nearly every week. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for other Jonathan Gold suggestions. Right now, there is a lot of talk in town about tacos. LA is home to some great taco trucks and taco stands. LATaco.com is holding a taco tournament, allowing voters to choose the best taco in Los Angeles. The final four includes Yuca's, King Taco, Kogi, and Tacos Por Favor. The winner of LATaco.com's Best LA Taco will be announced on Monday. Tell me your favorite taco truck or stand, and I will tell you mine. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and let's share intelligence. And I've even got a new video online about L.A. tacos. You can download it on iTunes or watch it on kcrw.com/goodfood. When it comes to pie versus cake, I have to say that I'll take pie any day. And the best thing about a pie is when the filling touches the buttery, flaky crust. But how do you make that perfect pie crust? I'll tell you next when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. We thought it was about time to have a primer on flowers. Why there are so many different ones, and does it really matter which one you use? Cindy Mouchet is a longtime California baking teacher. Her new book, written as part of the Sur La Table series, is The Art and Soul of Baking. And I have to tell you that this is one super skilled lady, and if she's written down a recipe, it works. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Evan.
So flour. Are they all created equal?
Oh, absolutely not. And this can make or break recipes, and a lot of people don't realize that. And I think it's one of the undercurrents in baking that's going on in pastry chefs' heads that doesn't always get translated to the home baker. And, of course, we all tend to use all-purpose flour because it's all-purpose. And is it the best flour for everything? It's sort of a medium flour. No, but can you reasonably make almost everything from it? Yes, with some exceptions.
Now there seem to be a lot more choices out there, even when it comes to all-purpose flour.
Yes.
There's, of course, bleached or unbleached.
I always recommend that people use unbleached all-purpose flour. I think that we are way past the time when bleaching our flour so that it's pure white is really either a good idea or even important in any way. Cake flour, you have to buy bleached. There's no way around that. But all-purpose, bleaching is just bad for the environment, and it's not good for our bodies. And unbleached flour tastes better because of that.
Is the structure of it different because of the bleaching?
It actually ends up being a little bit weaker, the proteins in it. Unbleached flours also absorb more liquid in general. So if you are, say, making pie dough, and people always say, oh, I don't know how much water to add to my pie dough. It's always variable, and I'm never sure. Well, say you're using the pie dough recipe in my book, which calls for unbleached flour, but instead you use bleached flour. It won't absorb as much liquid, which means that when you add the amount of liquid the recipe calls for, your pie dough will be wet because it can't absorb it.
And you don't want a wet pie dough.
You definitely don't want a wet pie
dough. Now, why not?
Because they're very hard to work with. Usually when you have a wet pie dough, it can be frustrating to roll out. It sticks to the table. You end up needing to use a lot of flour to roll it out. And then the thing that happens in the oven with liquid is it evaporates in the heat. So you put a wet pie dough in the oven and you get lots of shrinkage going on.
Okay, so we've talked about all-purpose flour and whether we should use bleached or unbleached. You've touched a little bit on cake flour and on high-protein flours or bread flours. Let's talk a little bit more about those.
Okay. Cake flour has the lowest amount of protein. It's made from a very soft wheat, which means that it doesn't have the basic protein it needs to make something like bread. So it's perfect for cake, where you want a very tender crumb. It's going to be baked in a pan. It doesn't need to hold itself up like a loaf of bread might need to in the middle of a sheet pan. So it helps make a very tender, soft, fine-grained crumb. And you absolutely cannot get that same crumb with, say, an unbleached all-purpose flour. It's a completely different cake. And if you did have to substitute another kind of flour, the most important thing would be to make sure that you use the same weight. Cake flour has different weight than all-purpose flour. And we pastry chefs are crazy about weights.
Yet no professional pastry chef measures with cups.
No. At the essence of it all, baking is chemistry.
And so it's about proportion.
It is. It's all about ratio. And to get consistent results and beautiful results, you need the correct ratio time after time.
And we should say that every time you use the word protein, you could also be using the word gluten.
You could. Protein is not gluten, but gluten is made from protein. So there is natural protein that occurs in all kinds of wheat flours. And when you mix that protein with any kind of liquid, which of course every baking recipe has, whether it's eggs or milk or water, that combined with the protein and then an agitation of some sort, like mixing or kneading, that makes gluten. So protein plus liquid plus mixing or kneading equals gluten.
Is there anything else that high protein flour is good for that we may not have thought of?
It's really great for rolling out doughs. Pastry chefs always use it as their flour of choice when rolling out pie doughs or tart doughs or even large batches of biscuits and scone because it has a low starch content. It doesn't stick to your baked to your doughs that you're working with.
And it doesn't create a tougher crust?
No, because you're not mixing it in. You don't want to mix the flour in as you're rolling it. You simply want it to cover your surface, though, so that your dough will actually
slide out. It's your dusting
flour. The dusting flour. Yes.
Oh, very interesting. Every single time we have a conversation, I learn something. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Pie crust tips can be found at kcrw.com/goodfood. Cindy Mouchet is the author of The Art and Soul of Baking, which is really a beautiful and delicious book. Lots of us grow food in our backyards and front yards. As I can tell you, it's often more than one family can eat. So why not just share it with the neighborhood? One Glassell Park resident is doing just that. She created her own neighborhood food co-op. Stick around. I'm Evan Kleiman, and Good Food will be right back. Doesn't it just break your heart when you see gorgeous fruit on our Southern California fruit trees that just falls to the ground unpicked? Well, in the hills of Glassell Park near Mount Washington, there's a solution, a neighborhood cooperative where residents share their goods from their gardens. Just imagine a bag of fruit, vegetables, herbs, and even canned goods. Hendon Walsh created the cooperative. Hi, Hendon.
Hi.
So what made you decide to do this?
Well, just what you said, I would walk in the hills, every day, and I'd just see all this fruit just dying on the trees. And I would think, are we really this rich that we can just let all this food die? And I thought, well, I can't steal it. How can I get my neighbors to all share in all of this great food that's happening for free, just growing out of the dirt and our yards. So I figured out that the thing I had to do was just do all the work.
Yes, so. that is the secret to a lot of community organizing.
So I sent out a big email and came up with the idea for the Hillside Produce Cooperative. So one Saturday a month, what happens is I'll either come pick up people's fruit that they don't want. It's not even like, I'm going to take everything you have. No, just what you have extra that you can't use yourself. Because no matter how much you love lemons, you just cannot use 25 pounds of them yourself, usually. So I would come pick up the fruit or people would drop it off at my house. Then I just redistribute everything and then deliver a big bag of everything that everybody has. So
how many people are involved in the cooperative right now?
Well, right now it's about 15 families, and I can't even believe the amount of food we get just from 15 families.
Give me an idea of what has been in the bag over the past couple of distribution times.
Well, it's pretty overwhelming. On our first exchange, range, which was in August, we had sweet plums, tomatoes, figs, pomegranates, lemons, oranges, two kinds of apples, Thai peppers, jalapeno peppers, grapefruit, oregano, basil, thyme, rosemary, mint, pineapple, sage, winter savory, catnip, bay leaves, French tarragon, cilantro, Swiss chard, and lettuce. So it was a lot of stuff.
That's amazing. Now, how much of it is actually cultivated and how much of it is on trees that people bought their homes with these old fruit trees? And
well, it's about, we have less gardeners, so I'd say most of it is just stuff that happened. Like in my case, I just have a whole bunch of fruit trees and wanted to share, you know, but I don't know anything about gardening. I have a couple of gardeners on the exchange and they're amazing. They're very excited. They're like, well, I'm going to plant everything.
It's like having a neighborhood CSA. It's so wonderful.
Yeah.
And what about, do you have anybody involved who maybe doesn't have any, they're not gardening, they don't have fruit trees, but they make things, like they make jam from stuff they buy in the farmers markets, maybe?
Yes, I have a chef who lives in West Hollywood who participates when we have just a huge excess of something. And what she does is can stuff. She's like, I'll make sauces, I'll, you know, just do the canning. And maybe at some point I get reimbursed for the jars, but I don't really care.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's my whole thing is I want everything to be free. Always, there is no money involved.
No, that's really quite amazing. Now, what is your goal? Do you have a goal?
Well, yes, I would love for this to be even bigger because it's not that much work. It's maybe 3 hours once a month. So my goal is to set up a website and have one person, because it only takes one person to organize a neighborhood, do this from all different neighborhoods around Southern California, and maybe once in a while we can call each other and say, so how's it going? Or maybe you'd like to trade cross town, you know, one day, which could be really fun.
So I understand that you do a lot of voices for cartoons.
Oh, yes, I do.
Maybe one of your characters has been involved in in picking fruit.
Oh, well, if I could choose one who could help me pick fruit, that would definitely have to be Starfire on Teen Titans, because she can fly. And she can blast energy out of her hands. That's very helpful for picking those stubborn apples way up high.
Hinden, it's a pleasure. And I love the idea that one person can create so much change in a neighborhood.
Oh, I hope so. A goal I have even beyond connecting all the neighborhoods in the city is to eventually give the excess to food pantries. You know, that seems they only want canned and packaged food at the moment.
Well, I've heard that a lot of food pantries are starting to move to more fresh food. So they'd be more open now. Thank you so much, Hinden.
Thank you.
Hinden Walsh is an actress by day and food co-op creator in her spare time. I hope you'll be inspired to do something similar in your neighborhood. If you do, definitely let me know. You can post it online at kcrw.com/goodfood or email us at goodfood@kcrw.com. Be my Facebook fan. Add me, Evan Kleiman, to your profile. We've got book giveaways and all kinds of other fun stuff there. Also, did you know that you can embed this show on your blog or webpage? Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click listen. You can read the Good Food blog there too. Good Food's executive producer is the fabulous Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Gary Macias is our music supervisor. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.